Most listeners have probably heard about the Houston Chronicle's investigative series revealing that at least 35 Southern Baptist ministers with well-documented histories of sexual misconduct allegations were still able to get jobs in the church. Timothy Redden was convicted of possessing child pornography, the story explains, yet he was still able to serve as a pastor. Charles Adcock faced 29 counts of sexually assaulting a 14-year-old girl in Alabama, but that did not stop him from volunteering as a worship pastor, and so on and so forth. Having read this news last week, some regular churchgoers might have opted to stay home yesterday. Others might have gone with heavy hearts and expectations that this issue would be addressed from the pulpit. If any of that describes you, call 816-235-2888 to talk to us about what you wanted yesterday and whether you got it. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to hear about the local response to misconduct in sacred spaces. My first guest is Emily Yeager. She's blogged about her own experiences with abuse in the church, and she's here to offer a personal experience. Emily, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Thank you for joining us. This news must have really brought up a lot for you.
Absolutely. Triggering is a very mild way to put it.
You've been on this journey, which you call a crazy ride, for the last 15 years. What can you tell us about the last 15 years and what you've been through?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was raised in a very conservative Baptist family. We went to church every Sunday, but we harbored a deep secret. And when I was approximately 10 years old, I started experiencing sexual abuse from my father. And that continued on until I was around 20 years old. And unfortunately, because of being in the evangelical world, I was not really taught very much about sex or sex education. Certainly was not taught about sexual abuse. And so while I hated every minute of it and I felt like a piece of my dad's pornography for 10 years, I had no words to actually really put to it. And though I tried to reach out, I was continually shut down. And then when I was 12 years old, my family joined a homeschool organization. And it was a worldwide ministry started by a man named Bill Gothard. This was back in 1960 or so that he started this. He would host these seminars that would fill stadiums, and he would preach about these godly basic principles. And that, to this day, 2.5 million people have attended his seminars. And so we joined this homeschool organization where we had this curriculum that we would use every morning, and we would attend these homeschool conferences every year. And it felt like paradise to me at the time. It felt safe and secure because I was around these people that were just all these godly, wonderful people, and they were safe and they weren't this scary outside world. But what I didn't realize was paradise was actually a fundamentalist patriarchal cult, and that the cult leader, Bill Gothard, the man that I revered so much, that I called the modern day Apostle Paul, and that I thought was as perfect as could be, he was actually the cult leader. And he discovered me when I was 13 years old at a conference, and he began sexually grooming me, and that behavior lasted until I was 18 years old. And when I went up to the headquarters of the cult in Chicago, and he had promised to help my family. He said he was going to counsel me, and he was going to counsel my dad, and he was going to help me. But when I got up there, he told me that he had lied, and that he had only told me he would counsel me because he thought that was the only way he could get me up to headquarters. But instead, he wanted me to make a long-term commitment to live there and work with him. And I felt like ultimately I was being asked to sell myself. I wanted help for my family, but in order to do that, I had to sell myself, and I wasn't willing to do that. So I walked away, and 6 months later, I came across a website called recoveringgrace.org, And on there was a story from a woman back in 1992, which was the year I was born. And she said that she had been sexually harassed by Bill. And I read that and I just got chills because I realized that I could have written that story. And to this day, or at least over the last several years, over 65 women have come forward. And a few years ago, I joined a lawsuit with 18 fellow victims of Bill. And we tried very hard. We fought the most difficult battle of our lives for 3 years to find justice. And we did not find the justice we wanted to by any means. Our justice system is pretty broken in the United States. But we continue to fight for that justice. We did at least find our voices. And we are never going to be silenced again.
You know, I am unfortunately fairly certain that abuse happens in every type of setting. So the fact that it happens in churches is not necessarily unique in and of itself. But the particular sense of betrayal a person must feel when it happens in what they understand to be a sacred space, that sounds like it very well could be unique. What are your thoughts about that?
I have seen, especially in the evangelical slash patriarchal world, that it has become a breeding ground for abuse. Number one, it silences victims. It does not allow women in particular to have voices, especially in the patriarchal world. You're taught a lot about shame and how you have to try to earn God's love and approval. At least that's what I was taught in the cult. And you have to do all these various rules. You have to wear the long skirts and you can't cut your hair and you have to eat a certain way in order to get God's approval. And if that's not happening, or I should say, if your life isn't perfect, then it means that that's your fault. So a lot of times, victims that are becoming sexual abuse victims, they think it's their fault because God must be angry at them. So they're trying to fix it themselves. And then also with this patriarchal society, it just enables the abusers to continue the abuse without repercussions.
Has your experience affected your belief system, your relationship with spirituality or faith?
100%. The most beautiful part about this journey was I discovered Jesus through it. Despite growing up in such an incredibly conservative home and just being taught about God all the time, I was taught about God the Father being this harsh, authoritative figure that was just waiting for me to make a mistake and strike me down dead or punish me in some way. I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease when I was 13, and I was told for years, that's my fault because, you know, I must be doing something wrong, and that's God's punishment on me. And so when I joined the lawsuit and I started getting into counseling and I started learning about how this everything I was taught was wrong and this was a cult and, you know, this is not who God is, it almost broke me. And I got to the point that I was on my bedroom floor, curled up in a fetal position a couple of years ago, and I was crying my eyes out. And I just cried out to God. And I said, God, I don't know who you are anymore. And, you know, the God that I'm being told about now through counseling is not the God I grew up with. And I don't know who you are. And I just pleaded with him and I said, I have tried for 14 years to earn your approval and it's not getting me anywhere. And I've tried for several months now to walk away from this legalistic prison that I've been in and I can't do it. And I just cried out and I said, Jesus, I'm a lost sheep and I need you to find me. And I'm too weak to walk. I need you to carry me. And that was the night I stopped trying. I stopped trying to earn God's love and approval, and I started living. And I realized that God's greatest commission to Christians, his only commission, is to love. Love covers all. We're to love God and love each other.
You know, that's quite a statement about a transformation of a faith relationship. I'm interested in your relationship with community. Personally, just as a fairly secular person who grew up in a faith community, but not a Christian faith community, I am personally much more attached to the community piece of my religion than any other aspect of it. And a betrayal of trust from within that community at the highest levels of leadership is something that I would experience as a major loss, not just regarding faith, but regarding community.
Absolutely. It was an ultimate betrayal. Part of my story, which is so difficult, is the fact that after I had been experiencing sexual abuse from my father for many years, I went to my pastor at the time, a local pastor, and I told him in explicit detail exactly what was happening. And I explained, I am being molested. All these things are happening to me. And yet he accused me of lying and being a bitter, rebellious daughter who was just out to get my father. So I went to church authorities and spiritual leaders, and I was torn down every time. And then when it came to Bill Gothard, the man that he was the Pope, the President, and Justin Bieber rolled into one. He was just, you know, the ultimate authority figure, and I just worshiped the ground he walked upon. And then to have that man betray me in such an extreme way, it really broke me. And to this day, I'm still having to deal with trust issues with men in particular.
What would you say to church leaders about what can and should be done to prevent abuse?
I think there's three main steps. Number one, you absolutely have got to give the victim the benefit of the doubt. There's all these concerns about how victims are bringing forth false allegations, but the data proves that is extremely rare. And so instead, if you are a pastor or a position in spiritual leadership, you have got to give the victim the benefit of the doubt first. Secondly, you have got to stop dealing with crimes solely within the church. We have this idea that, you know, oh, well, this is sexual abuse, this is immorality, so this needs to be dealt with in the church. No, we're talking about a crime here. You have, as a pastor, a civic and moral obligation to go forward and get law enforcement involved. And so that's really crucial as well. And then third, you've got to support the victim in very practical means. So I think one of the most beautiful things that we can do as Christians is to give of our resources generously and unconditionally, but do not enable. And so what that looks like is it's not about counseling their abuser and just saying, oh, I'm going to pray for you. No, it means first and foremost, make sure that victim has a safe and secure place to live. So get them away from their abuser and do whatever is necessary to find them a safe place to live, and then help them with practical things like groceries and childcare, and give of emotional support as well. Make sure they're surrounded by a healthy community.
Okay, hang on with me, Emily. I want to turn to someone who is a church leader and one who cares about this issue a lot. Cheryl Jefferson Bell is with us from Church of the Resurrection. That's a Methodist church. She's an associate pastor there. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, Gina.
Is it hard for you to hear Emily's story?
Oh, yes. Breaks my heart. As clergy, as leaders in the church, people put their trust in us. They are vulnerable to us. And to hear that there are those leaders that have violated that, it just hurts me to the core of my being.
We just heard that what Emily thinks churches can and should do to prevent abuse. What are your thoughts?
I agree with her. I think one of the first things that we should do is to believe what we are being told, and to take victims at their word. Also in supporting them as far as what next steps are, is crucial, not to abandon them, to let them know that we love them, we know that God loves them, and to walk alongside of them on this journey.
The legal standard, of course, is innocent until proven guilty. It sounds like you don't think that should be the community standard within a church community.
You mean as far as victim is concerned or the perpetrator?
Perpetrator.
Yeah. I think it's important for us to believe the victim and then investigate, learn more, try to learn more about the situation and the individuals, and then decide how to go forward from there.
You know, Did you feel like it was important to address this news out of Houston from the pulpit this Sunday?
I know we did not do that, but it is important.
Why?
Well, I'm not in charge. Amen. And I think that it's important for the issue to be dealt with as far as from the pulpit. Different churches have different ways of how they deal with current issues, and so it would be an individual decision on how that's done.
What do you think it would mean to do that from the pulpit? Do you think that that would make a difference for there to be a stance from a church mm-hmm. if there's someone listening who might later or already need support?
I think it is something that should be talked about. When and how that's done, of course, is left up to discretion of whoever's preaching or the pastor. But yeah, I think it is an issue that needs to be responded to and talked to from the pulpit.
You've done work with MOXA, mm-hmm. a local advocacy group, and we'll be talking with someone from MOXA shortly. Mm-hmm. But when did you decide that that was important to do as someone who worked in the church? What inspired that?
Our church, United Methodist Church of Resurrection, has a partnership with MOXA. We know that we don't have all the resources and knowledge to help folks that come to us and are victims of sexual abuse. And so to work with a group, an agency that's geared towards that and has that proficiency is important for us. So we appreciate our relationship with them.
You know, I'm curious what that collaboration has yielded. What are some of the things that you think your church might do differently as a result of that engagement with the topic of mm-hmm. sexual assault?
Well, they have been to Church of Resurrection in partnership as far as educational events. We had a movie that was being shown, and they were there not only to provide education but also support for those that may have been victims of sexual assault. And so that's the way our partnership has looked. And so we, again, appreciate them.
You know, Emily, I asked you earlier what you would want to say to church leaders. Anything you want to say to fellow survivors in the church or elsewhere, or to family and friends who want to know how to support people?
Absolutely. Well, I would want to say to survivors that it is not your fault. Mm-hmm. There is absolutely nothing that you have done to cause this or to be deserving of this. And most importantly, that Jesus is still there with you. When a couple years ago, I had a very pivotal moment where I was asking God, why? I said, why did you let this happen? Why did you just stand there and just watch as this abuse was taking place against me? And I said, I was crying inside, Jesus. Where were you? And I distinctly heard him say, I was right there with you crying too. And God gave us a beautiful gift when he created us. He gave us the gift of choice, and he loves us enough not to take that away. And so he was not going to take away my father's choice or Bill's choice to hurt me, but Jesus promised that he was going to stay beside me through that pain. He was grieved by that evil, and he promised me that he redeemed every tear I have shed on the cross 2,000 years ago.
Amen.
Cheryl, for you, I mean, do you think that there does need to be a theological response and interpretation of what happens when people go through these things?
There is. At least I can speak or won't speak on, but I know in the United Methodist Church that we have statements that say, you know, that violating the boundaries, sexual boundaries of another, of children, youth, vulnerable adults, other adults, is wrong. And so I know that there are some denominations that have taken a stance and have a statement on record.
Well, Cheryl Bell, Associate Pastor with Church of the Resurrection, thank you so much.
Amen. Thank you.
And Emily Yeager, thanks so much for sharing your story.
Of course. It was an honor. Thank you.
In just a minute, we'll hear from advocacy groups and you, 816-235-2888. This is KCUR's Central Standard. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about what regular churchgoers in Kansas City might have wanted from their pastors yesterday after the painful news of pervasive abuse in the Southern Baptist Church, news that came out in an investigative report by the Houston Chronicle in partnership with the San Antonio Express News. You can call 816-235-2888 if you had hopes about how this would be addressed, whether this would be addressed, and we'd love to hear whether you got what you hoped for. 816-235-2888. I'm joined in studio now by two advocates for survivors. Melanie Austin is Director of Education at MOXA, Kansas City's go-to resource for preventing sexual assault wherever it happens. Hi, Melanie.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Are you hearing from local church leaders who want help addressing abuse and assault and making sure their communities feel safe and heard right now?
Yeah, we often have folks from churches contact us, whether that's to provide education and outreach at their service or provide information about services that we have available for their members.
And I'm also joined by Stephanie Crable. She's with us from an organization that works specifically on abuse in the church setting. It's called Into Account, and Stephanie is the executive director. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Can you explain the name of your organization? I'm intrigued. Into Account.
Yeah. I can tell that it confuses some people because I occasionally get recruiting from accounting related. I get accounting junk mail. But the reason that we called our organization Into Account was that we were noticing in organizations that serve churches in relation to sexual abuse, there's a lot of talk about prevention and there's a lot of talk about healing, but there isn't a lot of talk about what happens when somebody accuses a perpetrator in the church and you have layers of cover up. You have church leaders who either are the perpetrators themselves or are complicit. And you have to deal with what happens to a community when somebody in that community is accusing somebody else in that community. And up until now, that burden has very much been on survivors themselves. There just hasn't been a very rigorous response in any church. And I think what we're seeing right now with the continuing revelations in the Catholic Church and the stuff that came out this past week about the Southern Baptists, that this is a huge moment of reckoning in our culture, and I think it's just beginning. I think it's going to unroll in every denomination, and there's going to be a continuing need for organizations like ours that can work with survivors when they're trying to figure out, okay, you know, I'm not happy with my church. I don't want to leave necessarily, or maybe they have left, and they still want some level of accountability from the church. We work with people when they're at that stage to say, okay, here are what your options are. You know, do you want us to introduce you to a lawyer? Do you want to have some sort of discussion with the church leaders? Do you want to go public with your story? What kind of support do you need for that? Like, we basically just work with survivors to negotiate their options for accountability.
How did you get started doing this?
It's kind of a roundabout story. I'll try to give you the shorter version. But I have a PhD in American Studies from KU. And while I was there, my dissertation research was on the LGBT justice movement in the Mennonite Church. And if you look at what's happening in terms of the way that the church confronts its own heterosexism, you will always find sexual abuse in those stories, because for one thing, because LGBTQ people are disproportionately targeted as victims, and also because the church frequently projects its own abusive dysfunction onto LGBT people. You know, you hear this in the Catholic Church when they blame homosexual priests, you know, so to speak, for abuse, which is, of course, nonsense. It is nonsense. But I got very invested, you know, as somebody who was taking in lots and lots of stories, as somebody who was studying institutional violence. I am someone who's just, activism is kind of the way I move through the world. And so when I finished that degree, some of the people that I worked with in the course of my research, we started hatching the idea for Into Account. We also did some volunteer work with the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, which is quite active here in Kansas City, and got some really key mentorship and education from that time. And then we got around to forming into account a few years ago.
Do you think that, like, the kind of work that they do at MOXA, which is, deals with sexual assault wherever it is happening, do you think that having a resource where it's like this, there are sort of best practices across the board, are there limits to the usefulness of that when you're talking about the church setting because of its particularities? Or is that incredibly useful to say, like, hey, this isn't about the church, this is about abuse wherever it happens?
I just both and yes, we need all of these services. It is an organization like MOXA is indispensable for churches when they actually use it. One of the first things that I say to church leaders when they come to me and say, you know, we have the situation and we don't know what to do, I say, well, okay, what experts have you consulted? Because Emily was right that churches tend to keep it in-house and they cannot do that. They need to, you know, whether they need to contact law enforcement or whether they need, if you're dealing with an adult survivor, you need to work with them through their options. You need to have a bunch of resources at your disposal, and organizations like MOXA have to be on that list.
Melanie, what are your thoughts about what is the same about abuse in a church setting as abuse would occur anywhere? And what is particular in your experience?
Well, I think that really in any setting, what makes sexual abuse and assault so difficult is often the perpetrator is known. You may really care for that person. You may love that person. And so that betrayal of trust is often very difficult, whether that's from a church leader, from a trusted coach, a teacher, you know, whoever that person may be. You know, they're often, again, trusted and loved, and it can be very difficult to believe that they would commit that crime of sexual abuse or assault. And so in that sense, I think it's very similar in people's experiences.
What about this piece of it? I'd be curious about both of your responses to this, that Emily shared a sense of sex and sex education being taboo, and therefore that adding a layer of challenge as far as everything from a victim being able to put words to what's happening to just the ability to feel safe having an open conversation if something that shouldn't be happening is happening.
I'll go ahead and jump in here. So, you know, with MOXA, we provide education and outreach throughout the metro, and we're in over 30 school districts. For young children, we have a program called Project Aware, where we're really talking about safe and unsafe touch. And oftentimes, we get a lot of disclosures from children because they then realize that maybe what's happening is an unsafe touch. And also, you know, just providing that information in middle school and high schools, you know, because when you're a child, you know, if something's happening to you and nobody is telling you any different, you know, you don't know that that might be a crime or, you know, what's happening to you is a crime. So I think providing that education and that awareness is really key. And also it's key for adults as well.
Stephanie, what's your sense of why that might be challenging in the church setting? Or is there another way you see that? Do you see there being a particular opportunity in the church setting?
I mean, I am kind of mired in the challenge right now, so I guess I'll speak to that. And I think it's a theological problem. And I think Emily got at some of why it's a theological problem, which is that the church treats sexual abuse, and I'm speaking very generally, but very generally speaking, the church talks about sexual abuse as sexual immorality. Now, sexual immorality is a category that, you know, particularly if you come from a patriarchal conservative tradition, your sexual morality is centered around heterosexual marriage. And so the way that you gauge the rightness of sexuality is whether or not it's practiced within the context of heterosexual marriage. So not only does that not account for sexual abuse that can happen within the context of a heterosexual marriage, but it also basically puts the label of immorality on everything else. So, you know, what I see Like when I talk to college students who go to Christian colleges, for instance, you know, they'll have like a campus policy where they're not supposed to have any sort of premarital sexual contact. That's how it's usually described, that sort of language. And so, you know, you'll have situations where people start making out or, you know, they consent to some level of sexual activity. And then at the point that they say no, you know, no means no. But if at that point their assailant continues, at the end of that, they're left with, well, we both participated in sexual immorality, when in fact, one person consented to some sexual activity, but not all, and the other person committed a violation. So there's a really important distinction in how we talk about violations and abuses of power versus talking about sex. And that's going to be a big deal for the church. We're not there yet.
You know, I mean, as someone who is not Christian, I don't know the answers to a lot of basic questions about theology within Christianity. I'm wondering, when you talk to people in churches and you say there is a theological problem, do you get pushback on that?
Oh, yeah. 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 I mean, I have worked with people from a pretty wide, I guess, political range, I might say. And I don't want to say that there aren't many, many people in the church who are making these arguments. There are. I mean, I'm not saying anything that people aren't saying all around the Christian world. But power does not concede easily. And patriarchy is still really like the organizing power structure of most Christianity. So I mean, what I find is that I don't know how to do this work and be apolitical because this shakes the foundations. You look at the issues that Christians have identified as their key political issues in the United States, just to limit it to the U.S., and they are issues that are very wrapped up in patriarchy and control of women's bodies and women and children being treated essentially as property. They're also wrapped up in white supremacy, the idea of sexual purity as something that is cherished and once lost can never be regained. There's a lot of very important racially coded language in we have a lot of work to do in terms of the unacknowledged abuses of power that happen in the church.
You know, bringing it back very specifically to what happened in Houston, not happened in Houston, but what was revealed by the Houston Chronicle about the Southern Baptist Church, I'm curious how much an intervention requires systematic solutions from the church with a capital C, and how much can be done on the level of just one house of worship, one caring pastor, one caring community.
Well, I think it depends on I would never want to tell people don't take on your own community because it's not worth it. If you're not going to take on the system, it's not worth it. Anytime you make a positive difference in somebody's life, it's worth it. But I do think that system-wide change is really, really necessary. I mean, there are a lot of people who are still in leadership, for instance, in the Southern Baptist Convention, who have been complicit in turning in looking away or enabling and concealing abuse. And they're still in leadership. They may be saying the right things now, but they're still in leadership. Those people are not qualified to lead, and they're very unlikely to produce change.
Let's turn to Melanie with us from Moxa. Melanie, let's imagine that here in Kansas City, there's someone listening who wants to enact change on that more individual level or just on the level of a house of worship. Mm-hmm. Do you have some practical tips and advice for that listener?
Yeah, I think first I just want to say, you know, prevention is possible and it's most effective when it's done on multiple levels. So if we can do prevention on the individual level, provide education, maybe they recommend to their church, hey, call Moxa, they can come in and provide education, or can we put up their flyers or their information? You know, that's one level. You can look at what kind of policies and procedures do you have in the church to keep kids safe. So that may be like you always have two adults in the room, or you have, if you have to meet with a child privately, you can do so in an area where you can be seen by others. So you can instill policies that keep kids safe, and you can recommend as an individual, you could recommend that to your church.
Anything else? Just we've heard so much today, so much of it very triggering, I'm sure, for all kinds of people. Can you offer anything just as far as people coping with this news on their own, just whatever their experience is that they bring to it?
Yeah. You know, Mox is a great resource, and we have a 24-hour crisis line that's a live answer 365 days a year. So you can always call us. You can go to our website at moxa.org and look at different resources that we have available, or reach out to somebody, you know, a friend, a family member, someone to talk to about what you're going through.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Our time is up for this conversation, but I want to thank everyone who joined us. Melanie Austin of Moxa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Stephanie Cable of Into Account, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Next on KCUR's Central Standard, a new role for libraries and librarians out there in communities. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now I'm joined by a health and wellness librarian. And if you are not sure what that is exactly, that's okay. It's kind of a cutting-edge thing they're just starting to try at the Kansas City Public Library, where Amanda Landayan is the first ever health and wellness librarian on staff. Hi, Amanda.
Hello, Gina. How are you?
Good. What is a health and wellness librarian?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. So it's so many things, and we're still really defining it. But actually, what we are doing as a library system, the health and wellness librarian is really just to start to raise awareness and bring programming in that focuses on those specific areas and really like holistic healthcare and what that can be. And we're trying to do it in a creative way.
So when you say creative way, can you describe some of the things you're doing? Because I think of library stuff as it usually, in my history anyway, the way I've accessed library resources are things that you can go get or do physically at the library or using the library's website. But you're going way beyond library walls, library websites.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we are going beyond. And even within the library walls, we have Zumba classes that we're doing every Tuesday and Thursday nights at some of our locations. We have kickboxing classes. So it's a lot of more interactive. It's not just you can come into the library and just get your book. You can also work out at the library.
You know, it is interesting. So what is how do you understand that as a library resource, an exercise class that would be sort of within the same category of what libraries have always provided?
Mm-hmm. So I think that's a really great question because we tend to think of just library resources as the typical books, as you were saying. But actually, this is a really great resource, too, because it's educational in a way that it's just really getting people motivated and engaged in participating and caring about their health in a way that's fun, that everyone wants to be a part of. And so library resources always need to be free, like accessible. And that's what we're providing is access for people to be able to participate in this great programming.
So like the way that a book that I might not be able to go and purchase just because I've heard it's great and I want to read it, like maybe I can't afford to take exercise classes regularly or like join a health club, and that the library is there to be that access piece more than about what the specific thing is that you're accessing.
That's correct. Yes. So exactly. Because we understand, you know, and we're really well, like situationally in the Kansas City area, we have so many branches and they're all in like people's just neighborhoods. So you don't always have to, it's really easy to just get to the library. We're on the bus line, like, you know, you can walk there. Yeah. And so that is you're exactly right.
But you also go to like community association meetings, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What are you doing there?
Yeah, so I actually am out in the community quite a bit. And what I'm doing there is really just trying to get a better understanding of what the health and wellness needs and concerns are from our library patrons. So, you know, I regularly attend like the violence-free KC meetings. I sit at the table at local community organizations working with them just so that we, because I really want my work to be shaped by the needs of our patrons.
So how do you bring that information back to the library? What does that process look like?
Mm-hmm.
And can you give me an example of a need that the community has informed you of that you would not have guessed if you were using your own expertise to just imagine those needs?
Sure. So one of the ways we had a really exciting program, actually, in a partnership with the Neighborhood Arts Residency in Charlotte Street. They had a collective, two artists, brought in other artists from Troost, actually, on their location there, to do this project called Start the Arts. And it was about violence and trauma and the healing that comes from participating in the arts. And so they had this all-day event where people could participate in different ways. So they had a culinary artist, which is really great. They had some spoken word artists. They had great children's programming. And that would not have come about had I not gone and just been sitting at a table or attended a local meeting that they were having saying that they wanted to do this and they needed sort of the space to be able to make it happen.
And so the library ended up providing space for what people were saying they wanted to do, like
exactly.
Physical space.
Yes, we were able to provide that physical space and help with the planning process as well because this was also new and we wanted to make sure that we could find the best way to serve this community and really get this idea because I think that's where the innovation comes from. And we had a great, wonderful turnout because, again, we were meeting the needs of what the community said they wanted and just really working with those partners. So that's a lot of what my work looks like. It's more of me partnering with individuals and finding ways to help shape their work and give them the room and space to grow it. I think that's really what is cool about the library as well.
Okay, I'm going to get very nerdy with you right now. So we talked about access, but when I think of libraries as like institutions of democracy, I think of them not just access generally, but access specifically to information, that the library is an institution that ensures that everyone has access to information. Is there an information piece of what you do and that you think is like should be considered like a pillar of democracy?
Oh my gosh, that's a really great question. So
it's
yes,
a giant question.
Yes,
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. So yes, we do focus on health literacy a lot, and that's something that nationally libraries are starting to focus on because we recognize the inequities that exist in healthcare. And one of the ways that libraries can do that is by providing access to information. And so yes, we're constantly working on that. And so one of the ways that I do that is I have a monthly newsletter that goes out. And sometimes that'll just be featuring a local community partner that's going to be providing some of that health information. Or it is just some tips and tricks that I'm putting on there and giving more resources for people to be able to go and locate. We also have some really innovative stuff that's happening. People are wanting to do. We have a pharmacist who comes in and is doing some really great health trivia games. So she's making
I think I need you to tell me more about
yes,
that.
Yes. Yeah. So she has Jeopardy style type questions that are all based in healthcare, like just raising your knowledge about how to use your insurance and just other general like health information. But it's
do people
fun.
Come to this? I'm so sorry, but like that I like even when I have to solve an insurance problem, sometimes I don't.
Yeah.
And so the idea that people would come in for fun, play trivia about insurance questions seems far-fetched to me.
Yeah. It's just still building, and so we're growing it. And I'm really excited because I've talked to some of our other community partners about, like, how could we make this, like, really something that people want to be engaged in. And so I'm excited to see how it could grow because we can do, we do prizes. And, you know, it's just this great environment where you just get to fun, you'll have fun and learn.
You said that libraries are starting to tackle health and wellness nationwide, mm-hmm. and that's related to a recognition of inequality in the health world. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah.
This is a first in Kansas City, right? A health and wellness librarian.
It is, absolutely.
It sounds like it's part of a
growing movement nationwide.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so it is part of a growing movement nationwide. I actually just attended a pre-conference for our Midwinter American Library Association about addressing the issues of implicit bias and health disparities. And so what we're just really recognizing is that nationwide, we are sort of a crisis, right, at this pivotal moment where these health disparities exist, especially when we're talking about people who live in brown and black bodies. And so what we can do as a library is really begin to find ways to bridge that gap. And so if it's through fitness classes, if it's through these trivia classes, we have a gentleman who does live chat with a doctor about diabetes. So those are some of the ways, again, providing that access and that information that individuals can come into, and it doesn't matter, right? Like you are, anyone can come to the library and get that information.
Tell me more about this live chat with a doctor. Is it, it's like dial a story, but instead of what you what everyone has access to is a bedtime story for their kids, everyone has access to a medical professional?
Yeah. So what this is it's similar to dial a story, yeah. We actually will have the program live, so individuals can come. So if you don't have access to a phone or computer or whatever for whatever reason, recognizing that digital divide too, this is a way that individuals can participate either from the comfort of their home or just on a computer, or they can come and sit and listen. And what happens is they will have some focus questions, and then they will also just have questions that the audience, they will take audience questions as well.
You know, it's my understanding, and I'm sure that a lot of different medical professionals feel really differently about this, but I do just casually know people in medical fields who themselves like wish things were more equal, more available, and that's just a problem that's beyond their ability to solve. Did you have a lot of interest from medical professionals in being part of this, like coming and doing something that everyone can access somehow?
Yeah. And so the gentleman who does it, he was really smart in the ways that he was thinking about it. And, you know, we are so close to local universities, right? We have KU Med. It's not very far away. And so a lot of those students or, you know, that are going through their residency, they are doctors that can provide some of this information, because some of it is just like basic, just like this is what you need to ask your doctor when you go in. Here are the concerns. And if they don't know, like, then they are able to be able to provide additional resources as well. So I think that's really, I thought that was pretty kind of smart for him to recognize that this is, can also be a resource.
What made you want to do this work at a library instead of somewhere else?
What I really appreciate about the library is that I truly believe that libraries are for everyone, and that there are no barriers to the programs that we provide. So if you have a you sometimes you don't even have to have a library card, right? Like you can just come in, and if you choose you want to participate, you get to. And that is what draws me to public libraries, because I think that there are very few spaces where that kind of programming exists without having to go through something extra, one extra step, or having to confirm that, yes, you do qualify for this, right? That is what is the beautiful thing about the public library and the services that we can provide.
What do you think are the challenges about doing health work in a library setting?
Yeah, I think some of the challenges, especially because we know we want to address the issues, let's say for mental health, right? But we want to be able to do that in this environment where anyone can come. And so sometimes the barriers can be that is, yes, we are a library, so we have to figure out how we can work with community partners to make that happen in a way that works for both of us. And so, you know, we do have partnerships with like Truman Medical. They are in one of our libraries and they do like blood pressure checks and those different things.
But you were saying something like mental health poses particular challenges in a library setting?
It can, yeah. And so we're just trying to get creative with it. And so I think one of the ways is just being able to do those arts and healing, and everyone can come and be a part of that and really look at it as self-care. Right? Because just our own mental health, doesn't matter where you're at, it's always going to be a part of that. Like, self-care is really important.
Well, our time is up. Amanda Landayan, Health and Wellness Librarian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Amanda joined us from the Kansas City Public Library. She is at their Northeast branch. You can listen to anything we talked about today at kcur.org/centralstandard. Today's show will be there by the end of the day. And you can sign up to have all of our shows sent to you like a podcast while you're there, kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, what is populism, and what does it have to do with this part of the country? Tune in for that conversation tomorrow at 10, and talk to us between now and then about anything you feel like. We are at KCURCST on Twitter, and we love chatting with our listeners. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.